Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you wildlife facts, conservation updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. It still shocks people to learn that here in England we have snakes, but we do, and one person who loves that fact most is PhD student who specialises in snakes and amphibians, Steve Elaine. The topic of snakes is a big one, so we kept this more specific to the UK species. However, of course, I asked some of the general questions like, are they all venomous, and how the heck do they move? But on from that, Steve told us about all the different species we can find here in this temperate island and how they vary. As always, we also discuss the current conditions snakes are in the UK and what is causing some of the declines. The usual suspects did come up, but at the end, Steve highlights some organisations to focus on in order to learn more about these reptilian beauties. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for joining me on Into the Wild, the podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on. First of all, and the most important question, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good.
No, I'm glad to hear it, yes. And you can probably hear it in my voice, but yeah, I'm just getting over the back end of a cold. I'm back to my nice cheery self again, which is great. And I can actually talk. I'm looking forward to talking to you today.
Yeah, great. It's a pleasure to have you on. And yes, back to talking. This is essential for a podcast, as I'm sure you're aware. So I'm glad you're feeling better and ready to talk. And before we start with our topic today, which is all about UK snakes, let's find out about you a little bit. Can you tell myself and my listeners who you are and what is it you do?
Sure. So my name's Stephen Elaine. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent, and I study grass snake populations and the effects of disease. Prior to, you know, getting involved working with snakes, which is a relatively recent thing, I spent 6 or 7 years working with amphibians and their infectious diseases. And so this is, you know, kind of like the next step up in terms of, you know, the evolutionary tree of moving from amphibians to reptiles. Although I do still dabble in quite a bit of amphibian work because, you know, I don't want the frogs and toads to think that, you know, I've just abandoned them when, you know, they were my first passion. I do quite a bit of work focusing around reptiles and amphibians, both here in the UK and abroad, either to look at, you know, population ecology or infectious diseases, and, you know, trying to piece everything together to work out how we can save those populations or at least mitigate those diseases in the wild, which isn't always terribly easy.
I love that wonderfully empathetic answer towards amphibians. I think the way you said, I don't want them to feel like I don't care about them anymore. What a wonderful, wonderful way to look at the animals we work with. Both with reptiles and amphibians, you were looking at infectious diseases. Is that an area of work that really interests you, or is that something that you've just fallen into?
A bit of both, really. So yes, when it comes to the amphibian side of things, chytrid, you know, is a disease that I'm sure many people would have heard of. If they haven't, it's an infectious disease that was first identified in 1998. And, you know, recently we've established that, you know, unfortunately, chytrid has been implemented in the decline of thousands of amphibian species worldwide and the extinction of it of a couple of hundred of species.
Mm.
And at the moment, it doesn't appear to be much we can do to cure it, at least, you know, at an ecosystem level. Yes, you can, you know, take frogs into captivity and, you know, treat them. But when you re-release them, you know, unfortunately, the fungus is still in the environment. You know, there's still other hosts and reservoirs, you know, in terms of other frog species out there that can, you know, retransmit the disease back to the ones you've just released. And you're trying to use the skills, the knowledge, and the you know, just the insight that I've learned and you know, developed over the previous 6-7 years prior to me starting my PhD working with chytrid and amphibian infectious diseases, to apply those to the reptile world to try to, yeah, just see what we can learn and how we can potentially prevent the future spread and any declines from these diseases in European snake species in the future. But yeah, the problem I'm facing at the moment is, apart from the whole coronavirus situation, is that there aren't too many people working on ophidiomycosis, which is the disease I'm working on in snakes. It used to be known as snake fungal disease. I know, very inventive, hey? it's since been renamed by the scientific community. You know, at the moment, you know, lots of the work is being conducted in the US, but there are very few people working on this disease in Europe, and I'm one of them. And yes, it's a little bit frustrating sometimes when you need to, you know, just get that reassurance from somebody that, you know, you're doing the right thing, but there's no one to ask.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. My next question then is, how and when did your love for wildlife and nature begin for you?
This is a very interesting question, and, you know, one I'm always asked by people. I think that, you know, my love and passion for the natural world was always there. You know, I can't remember a time when I didn't enjoy, you know, the natural world. And, you know, thankfully, you know, I had, you know, a very supportive family that, you know, saw my passion and, you know, helped foster it. Mm. And, you know, growing up, you know, my parents and grandparents would often take me out to wildlife parks or just to a nature reserve or, you know, whatever. And yeah, just let me go off and explore and, you know, do whatever I wanted to do. So, you know, I often recall dragging my nan around catching lizards or newts and stuff, and, you know, stories like that. And yeah, obviously from a young age and, you know, having the support and the freedom to do that, you know, really helped to cement my passion for the natural world and help me find where I am now.
That's so cool. And I love how everyone that I chat to on the show always has something where they're like, my parents had to put up with me being covered in mud, or I had to take my parents to go and see this, or my grandparents had to be taken to go and see lizards. And it's more like you said, having that supportive family that go, right, we're going to a crocodile sanctuary today because so-and-so wants to. And that's now moving on to our topic today.
Sure.
We're going to be talking about UK snakes, and you're a snake man yourself. Not literally. You're not literally a snake man. You're not a new Marvel superhero. Although that would be pretty cool. But this is what we're going to be discussing. And let's start with an obvious one. Now, what is it about snakes and reptiles and amphibians that you love so much?
This is an interesting question. I think the easiest way for me to answer that, you know, would be to take people out to see them, you know, in nature.
Mm.
And, you know, to just explain, you know, how interesting and fascinating they are. But to me, you know, it's the fact that not many people, you know, appreciate them for what they are. You know, they're quite often overlooked, but, you know, they are very intelligent and, you know, very charismatic animals. It's just that, you know, they're overshadowed by, you know, a number of feathery and furry animals. And so people, you know, tend to forget they exist. And because of that, they you know, they don't have the attention of these other species. And, you know, that has led to even our most common species being fully, you know, misunderstood and, you know, just leaving holes in our knowledge that you wouldn't have if they were a bird, for say. So, yeah, you know, it's the fact that, you know, that they are, you know, these amazing animals, but there's also, you know, the chance for discovery around every corner that, you know, just keeps me, you know, well and truly infused about them. And, you know, I'm always happy to share those experiences with other people and, you know, trying to get people involved in fighting their corner, you know, particularly with climate change and, you know, increased habitat loss. If people aren't fighting for the little guys, then it doesn't matter if you're, you know, trying to save the bigger animals because, you know, the ecosystems would have collapsed.
Now, this is an interesting, my next question, and I ask this because a lot of people ask me this question, and I wondered if you could give a more detailed answer. Is, I know we're talking about UK snakes, but let's quickly look at snakes globally. Are they all venomous?
So this is a very interesting question, and it comes down to what you regard as being venomous. And there are two schools of thought, and, you know, it's a tricky one. So potentially all snakes are venomous, but their venoms have been adapted in certain ways, so they're not medically significant. So because venom is just an adaptation of saliva, for example, with the larger snakes, such as the boas and the pythons, you know, they could be classed as venomous because their saliva, you know, is more, is, you know, has become more lubricated than other snakes. But obviously then you have other snakes such as vipers and cobras and stuff, which are known, you know, to be medically significant and produce venom that can, you know, kill or cause morbidity. But I think that teasing the you know, these two bits of the argument apart, just focusing on those snakes that, you know, inject you with a toxin that causes harm, now that's the way that I see the definition of venomous anyway. And so at last count, I think there's about 3,500 snake species worldwide. So they're quite a diverse group of animals. Of those, 600-ish are venomous. And of those, only 200 are medically significant. So ones that, you know, if they envenomate you, you know, there's a chance of death, or you need to seek medical attention. Obviously, if you get bit by any snake, go and seek medical attention, because, you know, there's the chance of transmission of salmonella and infection and other nasties and stuff.
And especially if you're in the UK, not only should you seek medical attention, but also review what you're actually doing, because to come across a snake and get bitten by one in the UK, you've got to be pushing the boundaries a little bit.
Unfortunately, most people that get bitten by snakes are people that are out on walks, and, you know, they're out with their friends, or they're out photographing snakes, and they got a point at it, and obviously they extend their body closer to the snake, the snake strikes, and, you know, the finger gets bitten. Don't point at snakes, guys. That's a lesson there. You can do it. You know, use a stick.
There's so many cool rhymes and rules with reptiles. There's never smile at a crocodile and never point at a snake. It doesn't rhyme, but it's still got the same kind of bell.
All it needs is a little bit of polishing up. I'm sure we can make it work somehow. You know, we will make it the new reptile jingle. Don't worry. You know?
We'll get there. Also, I think snakes, if they're going to win any award, it's going to be up there with the best movement award, because they move in such wonderful ways. But how do snakes actually, considering they've got no legs, or they might have remnants of legs somewhere, but they don't have any mobility in those legs, how do they actually move?
This is a very interesting question. So there are different types of snake movement. Some of the rattlesnake species in the US are pretty crazy, because, you know, they move along like a caterpillar, you know, and, you know, that's quite insane for a snake. But in terms of the species here in the UK, they tend to moving an S shape through the grass or through the water or whatever sort of substrate that they're on. And they use their belly scales, their scutes, as they can move them individually, but they use those for traction and to give them some grip whilst they're moving along. And yeah, it's interesting to, you know, to just watch a snake move through some short grass or over gravel or something, and just, you know, look at this movement, you know, side on, and see them repositioning things, you know, their scales to be able to do that. You know, in some species of snakes, you know, they've taken this to the extreme to allow them to climb vertical surfaces such as brick walls and trees and stuff. But yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, them have control over, you know, individual groups of scales to be able to act as traction for them to push off and, you know, move forward with, because it's completely alien to our mode of locomotion, because we have limbs. But I guess if we didn't, we'd probably use something very similar.
It is mesmerizing when you see it, and I think that's why people are so wary of snakes. As you just said there, it's so different to how we're used to seeing movement among mammals and animals we are used to. When we see it, it's kind of that I don't understand that, and I don't therefore trust it, because it's so different. Again, well, this kind of last question on snakes globally, but where can we find snakes? Is there any countries that don't have snakes?
So there are some countries that don't have snakes. Antarctica, to start off with. New Zealand doesn't have any. Neither does Iceland. Ireland doesn't have any either. There's a few, you know, the more remote islands that don't have them as well. But yeah, it tends to be places that are cold or isolated. But apart from that, they're pretty much everywhere else.
So there you go. Anyone listening who, for whatever reason, is not a fan of snakes, you know, I don't understand that reasoning, but everyone's entitled. Then you can go to Ireland, New Zealand, Iceland, or Antarctica. That's where you can live.
Well, I guess if you move to Antarctica, there's plenty of penguins to study. So, you know.
Yeah.
But the others, unfortunately, well, with Iceland, unless you're a geologist, you know, there's not much there to study.
I love the way you're looking at this from a work point of view.
Oh, yeah, of course. With New Zealand, you know, there's plenty of stuff to you know, conservation-wise, to get, you know, get on with down there. And the same with Ireland, so yeah.
That's the best response I could have had from yourself is, guys, if you don't like snakes, move to Antarctic. And you're going, well, look at the job opportunities first. Don't just move somewhere blindsided. Right, let's talk about UK snakes. Now, I guess to keep this a bit more simple, because snakes as a whole, as you said, about, you know, 3,000 plus species, there's a lot to talk about there. So I thought I'd shrink this down to UK. How many snake species do we have in the UK?
So, embarrassingly, we have 3 native species in the UK, but there are also 2 that have been introduced as well.
Oh, what are the two? Oh, well, actually, let's go through that. So, we've got 3 native species. What are they? Yep.
So, we have the barred grass snake, there's the adder, and the smooth snake.
Cool. And the 2 non-native introduced ones?
So, the most well-known one is the Asclepian snake, and then the second one is following the reclassification of grass snakes back in 2017. We have populations of European grass snakes here in the UK. So this is a bit of a taxonomic mess where it was, and it didn't help that, you know, people like the Telegraph and the BBC and everybody else was claiming that, you know, a new snake species had been found in, you know, here in the UK. But really, all that happened is that the grass snakes that we know and love had just been given a shiny new name. So they were elevated from subspecies level to species level. So, for God knows how long, 100 years plus, they've been known as Natrix helvetica. But they're now known as Natrix helvetica, which means that the introduced populations of European grass snakes, which come from Hungary or Bulgaria, are still Natrix, which is what, you know, the barred grass snakes used to fall under before this classification shift. So yes, there's very small isolated populations of European grass snakes around. So there's a 99.999% chance that every grass snake you've ever seen here in the UK swimming around, eating frogs and just doing its snaky thing is a barred grass snake.
Wonderful. Okay, so can we find these anywhere? I know you said there's certain hotspots for the European grass snakes, but can we find them anywhere in the UK, or are there certain areas that have an abundance or certain areas that have really pushed them out of ecosystems?
So when it comes to the barred grass snake, which is my study species, they're found pretty much everywhere from England and Wales. They get rarer the more north you go, and they're almost completely absent from Scotland, although whether or not they're present there is still an ongoing thing, and whether or not they're native, you know, is a whole different ballgame. Adders, unfortunately, are becoming extraordinarily rare in the country. Mm. New research published the beginning of last year, this year. It's all a blur. Recent research that was published shows that, unfortunately, adders are declining rapidly and they may be extinct all but a couple of strongholds by 2032.
Oh, wow.
So, you're extraordinarily lucky if you find one. And smooth snakes are our rarest reptile species. They're only restricted to a few heathland sites in Hampshire, Dorset and Surrey. And so, believe it or not, they're a constrictor and they feed on other reptile species. You tend to find them in these areas where there's a higher reptile abundance because obviously there's lots of food. And with the other 2 species, the Asclepian snakes, there are 3 known introduced populations, 1 in Regent's Park, 1 near the Welsh Mountain Zoo in Cowan Bay, and a 3rd one in Bridgend. Trying to find those guys is a complete nightmare because, you know, that their small population size is very secretive. And yeah, I guess you need to be quite lucky. And then, yeah, the same thing with the introduced European grass snakes is, yeah, trying to find them is like trying to find a needle in a haystack. But there are some out there.
What was the reason why these 2 other snake species were actually introduced to the UK?
It was just, you know, accidental releases. I'm not entirely sure if there was, you know, anything nefarious going on. The introductions, you know, were both, you know, during like the 60s, 70s and 80s, you know, for both those species and the various populations. Obviously, responsibility and the legislation and everything was probably a little bit more, lax back there. But yeah, I don't think, you know, people were, you know, emptying boxes and boxes of snakes into nature reserve to try and get these new species to establish.
And among our 5 species, 2 non-native including, do we have any venomous species if we're looking at venom from a medical perspective?
Yes, so the adder is venomous and, you know, it's quite infamous for this. Again, it's not exactly what I would call a typical deadly snake in the eye of the public. You know, they're not out there to, you know, to hunt you down while you're walking through like a woodland or a heathland. They're very shy. They don't like to engage in any sort of conflict. They will feel your vibrations from your footsteps or yeah. your bicycle or whatever, you know, from tens of meters away, and will scarp if they feel like there's any threat. If you do come across one that's just sitting out in the open, as we've already said, you know, give it a wide berth. In the springtime, males will be out basking you know, quite brazenly, because, you know, it's important for them to get their metabolism up to a level where they can start producing sperm to breed when the females come out of hibernation. So the males come out a little bit earlier, then the females come out, and then the breeding season starts. And unfortunately, if there's too much disturbance, you know, in those first few weeks, then the males can't produce the sperm that they need, and so they can't compete with the other males.
Now, we spoke a bit about the beginning about, you know, the importance of, you know, when we were talking about amphibians as well, about the role they play in our environment and the ecosystems. And, you know, I'm a snake lover, you're a snake lover. However, there will be people out there, even animal people, that are a bit cautious and may not be keen on snakes for whatever reason. But to help them grow their love for snakes, how and why are they important to an ecosystem?
Well, it depends on the ecosystem, I guess. But, you know, looking at things from, you know, the perspective of Northwest Europe, when it comes to, you know, comes to snakes, you know, they're not just food. They're not just predators even, you know, of, you know, pest species, but also food for, you know, a lot of other another species. So it probably surprised a lot of people to learn that, you know, snakes make up, you know, the diets, you know, particularly of birds such as buzzards and, you know, other predatory birds, because they are just essentially a sock of muscle you know, with some bones in them. I don't think you'd be able to fillet a snake very easily because all of its, you know, fiddly little ribs and the vertebrae, but they are, you know, particularly nutritious. But, you know, they also do this amazing job of keeping pests under control at the same time. So, yeah, it's you know, that dual purpose in that they're an indicator of a healthy ecosystem, but they also keep pest species at bay and under control. And, you know, they also feed other animals that people may be interested in, you know, such as, you know, these charismatic predatory birds such as buzzards and whatever else.
So, I mean, they're quite clearly, I mean, I know this anyway, but snakes are obviously a very important part of any ecosystem, like you said, from a pest control point of view, but also from being in that kind of mid-range of a food chain as well. They really are kind of one of those key species. But in the UK, what dangers are snakes in? What are the things that are happening which are pushing snakes away?
One of the biggest drivers of decline is habitat loss. Fortunately, you know, a lot of greenbelt land is being developed for housing, but also, you know, for hospitals and libraries and, you know, whatever else social infrastructure is needed or, you know, at least deemed required to sustain our growing populations. They're also, and because of the shrinking in habitats, they're also suffering from, you know, a loss of genetic diversity because populations become more isolated. They tend to inbreed more. That just leads to whole runaway effects. And, you know, when a population gets too small, it, you know, it can no longer sustain itself and just, you know, leads to a localized extinction. And then obviously, if you've got too many of those going on at the same time, then unfortunately, you can lead to county-wide extinction. So, that, you know, there are a few counties in England where adders are deemed extinct because no one's seen them for, you know, a couple of decades or more.
Oh, wow.
Because all of their habitat has been destroyed, or at least the habitat has been cut off from each other. And so those populations can no longer, you know, interbreed and you know, spread and share genetic information, which then leads to them becoming inbred and, you know, having these runaway extinction vortices that, yeah, just mess everything up. From my side of things, you know, there's the potential risk of disease as well, not just ophidiomycosis, but, you know, other diseases we don't know about yet that may be lurking in the shadows.
I guess so. Those are quite serious threats that snakes are facing, you know, quite challenging obstacles to overcome or even start to think about overcoming. To the listeners that are listening now that go like, you know, I want to help or I want to keep up to date with this, where can people go? Where's the best place to find out more about UK snake conservation?
So the best thing to do is to find your local amphibian and reptile group, so your local ARG. And if you go to the ARG UK website, which I believe is archivinggroups.org.uk, you can find all of the information there, and then, you know, get involved with your local ARG group. And, you know, that's the same if you want to work with amphibians or with reptiles, you know, in terms of monitoring and habitat management and, you know, outreach. You know, there's lots that can be done by, you know, everybody of you know, every ability, background. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a conservationist or not. You know, if you've got time to give to, you know, a worthy cause, then I'm sure people will, you know, chew your arm off. please do take a look at your local art group, but also there are other organisations out there. So the Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust, you know, holds a lot of, you know, scientific meetings, but also training workshops, although these are now online because of the whole coronavirus pandemic. Frog Life is another national charity that does some amazing work and, you know, has training opportunities, but their work tends to be focused in London, Peterborough, and Glasgow, although, you know, they are branching out a bit more elsewhere. Bigger conservation groups like the RSPB and the Wildlife Trusts, you know, also occasionally do bits and pieces to aid reptile and amphibian conservation, so you may be able to volunteer with those guys as well.
And my last question to you, Steve, is a question that I ask everyone on Into the Wild, and that's, if you could just pass on one bit of advice to everyone regarding the natural world, what would you pass on?
The most important thing, you know, particularly, you know, in this day and age, is that, you know, no matter what happens, you know, just keep on fighting, get out there and experience it for yourself. You know, it doesn't matter if you know what you're looking at or not. You know, you can still appreciate even the most minute things going on, you know, like the ants walking under your feet, carrying off sticks and twigs to the nest, etc. Just experience it while you can. When it comes to a cold, rainy day, then sit down and try to, you know, read a book and understand it. But, you know, get out there and see it for yourself while you can.
Amazing. Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about snakes, which is so evidently a passion of yours, which has been a pleasure to listen to today. I wish you all the best for the current lockdown and the rest of the year, and I hope you can get back to your labs soon to continue your lab work with your snakes. And I hope our paths cross again very soon.
So do I. Thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure to be on.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work Steve is working on, you can do so on Instagram and Twitter at @stevoelaine. Don't forget you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.